Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is the author of a piece that appeared in the New York Times on Sunday, The America We Lost When Trump Won. Our guest is Kevin Baker. He's a novelist and essayist and the author most recently of America, The Ingenious, How a Nation of Dreamers, Immigrants, and Tinkerers Changed the World. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, Harper's Magazine, and many others. He writes that America was always supposed to be something as much a vision as a physical reality. It's different, or at least it was. When he says that he has lost the vision of the America he knew, he's not talking about policy or even fundamental rights. He means a greater, almost spiritual faith that he had in his fellow citizens and their better instincts, something that served as his North Star in all that he wrote and all that he did. It has been described as a city on a hill, and many presidents have described it thus. We will be talking with him about a variety of issues, about the debates, about the convention, about the changes in policy, about whether it is unfair or condescending to say that all Trump voters were racist or sexist or that they hated foreigners. We will look at that. We will look at his comparison of the personal populist movements with Andrew Jackson, and much more this hour of the program. And welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Hello, Kevin. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you woke up the day after the election and?
Actually, it was more the day of the election. I woke up feeling I lived in America, which of course I did, and went to bed feeling that I might just as well be in Belgium or Ecuador or Thailand or Zambia, you know, all perfectly good countries, but countries that never had been either burdened or elevated by a sense of mission, by a sense that, you know, so much of what the world would become depended on what they would become. And that seemed totally wiped away by the end of the evening after my fellow citizens, at least a significant minority of them, chose to elect this man president.
You wrote about your parents. I always like to talk about our parents, who you described as political moderates who voted Republican as well as Democratic. But they would have been flabbergasted by the vulgarity of this whole election.
Yes, just the appearances that Donald Trump made in the debates, constantly cutting off his opponent, sneering, insulting, talking through everyone, the grandiose strongman claims, in his speeches at the convention, saying, "I alone can fix it." That was something that would have automatically disqualified him by their lights. And again, these were people who voted Republican as well as Democrat, who were pretty moderate their whole lives. They actually got a little more liberal as they got older, which is not the usual progression. But, these are basically Eisenhower Republicans to start in their voting lives, and they would have been just astonished to see this man on there. They would have been astonished to hear the language he used, to see him calling for his supporters to beat up demonstrators. All that sort of thing would have just automatically been a disqualification, no matter what he said he stood for.
Mm-hmm. And when you say something more is expected of us than is expected in Belgium or in Thailand or in Ecuador, what do you mean?
Well, it sort of has to be. I mean, first of all, because we are such a powerful nation, we've had the world's largest economy since I think the 1870s or 80s. You know, we have more military might than any power that has ever been on this earth. We are tremendously strong in terms of putting forward so-called soft power in our ideas. We are also, of course, the first major democracy in modern times, and the only nation made up entirely of immigrants. We are a test case in peoples of all over the world getting together and living peacefully together in one democracy. And overall, I think we've done a pretty good job of it. There have been terrible things that we've done, as all great powers have done. There is the terrible legacy of slavery in this country, of genocide against many Native American peoples, of other oppressions. But it had seemed to me that we were constantly, or if not constantly, we were overall moving forward toward living together in a more democratic and a more tolerant and inclusive way.
Mm-hmm.
And to vote for this man, I think, sets all of that back. And we're also supposed to be, as the world's largest economy, we have to really take the lead in doing things like protecting the overall climate of the planet. We have to lead the way, should be leading the way, on climate change prevention. And that's now not going to happen. And in fact, it's probably going to be completely reversed. It will lead a sort of acceleration, actually, of global warming and climate change. And this is not the role we were really meant to play. This is not the role that I was taught in school that we were supposed to play. It's a totally selfish attitude and something of a con game as well.
Let's talk about the role that some famous writers think that we ought to be playing or should have been playing. And let's go through some of their work. Certainly, you talk about Walt Whitman, who made it his life's work, one long ode to our young nation. You write about Nathaniel Hawthorne, Toni Morrison, people who feel that, you know, that we're a nation of contradictions, too, and betrayals. Richard Rider, Ralph Ellison, John Reed, certainly.
Yeah.
What do you like to point to in the bulk of their work that either celebrates America and should make us think of a vision that was at the founding of our nation and those who have struggled with America?
Yeah, I think that I would suspect that overall American writers make America a character in one way or another in their work, probably more than writers from any other country. I don't have any hard data on that, but we're always totally involved with America. We're always conscious of America. And that goes for people who have been quite critical of the country, as well as those who celebrate it, such as Whitman. Someone like myself, in my writing, I've put forward some of the more sordid and terrible incidents in our past, but have tried to look at them somewhat objectively. I wrote a series of three novels called The City of Fire Trilogy, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row, and they involved three different ethnic groups, Jews, African-Americans, and Irish-Americans, all of whom were not wanted in this country except in the most subordinate and silent positions. And all of them fought through to gain a major role in our culture and our society. And that, to me, is an uplifting story, even if a lot of the time it's an ugly one, it can be a brutal one. You know, democracy is a messy business, and I understand that. I expect that. A lot of democracy is fought out in the streets. It's fought out in the battlefields of the Civil War in this country. But overall, it did seem that it was in, you know, Dr. King's famous phrase, bending toward justice. It did seem that it was bending toward a better society, despite various setbacks. And now for the people to vote in these numbers for this cheap demagogue and expect things to get better, I find both such a wrongheaded and also such a truly passive reaction to what they are going through, that I fear for what is going to come next.
I think
something essential has been lost.
Let's talk about immigration for a moment. He's done a number of executive actions in the last couple days. It's hard to figure out exactly what it means for immigrants in this country because they can be very broadly interpreted. It certainly is a part of what makes America incredibly unique, that we are a nation of immigrants, that so many people have come here from me, my Irish family from after the potato famine. There are people who have come from all over. Don Donald Trump, in addressing the Republican retreat today, described the world as this, you know, bad place. There are dangerous people. Is it indeed perhaps a world that has changed significantly and there are more bad people who want to do us harm? And thus we need to change that very beginning of America, a nation of immigrants.
You know, that's an interesting point. I mean, I think the world has changed somewhat. As far as I can tell, acts of terrorism by some immigrants in the last couple of years are, I think, unprecedented in our history. There's no use denying that there is this terrorist movement out there, this fanatical religious movement, and there's no use, denying that we should. That we have to be vigilant in combating radical Islamic terrorism, as President Trump says. But at the same time, that doesn't mean we throw out everything. It doesn't mean we throw out all the amazing Arabic and Hispanic immigrants we have coming in. You know, it was interesting in doing this book, America the Ingenious, because it took 76 key inventions, things that Americans either invented outright or at least made viable and commercial. And counting up the number of people who I knew simply were immigrants involved with this, there were 65 immigrants and 15 children of immigrants, you know, quite possibly more. So immigration has always been kind of our lifeblood. It's always meant bringing in people who are, and let's face it, for the most part, the people who have the determination to come here and the ability to get here are people you want in a society. They're extremely determined. They want a better life for themselves and for their children. They're usually a terrific addition to us. And if we're going to arbitrarily cut them off now, I think we're going to just shoot ourselves in the foot again.
Mm-hmm. And this whole relationship with Mexico, now we have news today that the Mexican president said, I don't know, if it was mutually agreed that they weren't going to meet with each other, he said he wasn't going to come to the country. We're really off on a rocky start for many reasons with Mexico and certainly with people who are in this country, many of whom have been expressing a great fear about the future.
Yes. Yeah, that's a terrible thing. Mexican, Hispanic immigrants have been great additions to our country. And to put up this wall, beyond the, you know, the human cost, it's a terrible symbol. When John Kennedy and Khrushchev were faced off over Berlin and the Soviets built the Berlin Wall, there was some feeling in America that we shouldn't have let it happen. Well, that was sort of impossible. It would have meant invading this East Germany, Soviet-held territory, and probably set off World War III. But beyond that, our administration, while deploring the wall, felt that this was a great propaganda black eye for the Soviets, and it was. They had to put up a wall to keep people in, and now we're putting up a wall to keep people out. This, I'm sure, looks terrible all over the world. And it refutes what has long been, what we've long put out as our basic mission. You know, it's the words on the Statue of Liberty, give us your huddled masses, yearning to be free. That was the claim. That's the heart of American exceptionalism, which I do believe in, but I believe it has to be earned. And that was the claim that we made, was that people could come here for freedom. And anybody could be an American if they followed our laws and believed in our democracy. This has now been this part of our legacy has now been badly besmirched, and for no terribly good reason. And the wall won't even be that effective in keeping most illegal immigrants from coming in.
Well, let's talk about the people, and it's a minority of Americans who are eligible to vote. He was elected by, 27% of the American people. You write in your piece that, and we've had this conversation about whether or not it's unfair or condescending to say that Trump voters were racist or sexist, that they hated foreigners. You say, but if they were not, they were willing to accept an awful lot of racism, sexism, and xenophobia in the deal they made with their champion and demanded precious few particulars in return.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a president who in the first, literally the first 5 minutes of his campaign, referred to Mexicans as rapists and murderers. This is a man who has an incredibly sexist past record. This is a man who at all times sort of throws suspicion on many immigrants in this country. And this is a man who in his inaugural speech made out that basically the rest of the world just spends all its time bilking the United States. So I don't know how you can kind of take that and say, oh, well, I'm voting for this guy, but I'm not a racist and a sexist or whatever. All right, fine. But show me what the other, at least show me what the other great things are you think are going to come from this guy beyond these very vague slogans, make America great again, beyond what are so far simply promises to the rich to lower their tax burden. And corporations to make it easier for them to do whatever they want. This is a pretty vague promise, and it's pretty shocking that so many people fell for it.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear from some of those people, and we'll ask them to call at this very moment. We're talking about America and the vision of America. The America our guest believes we lost when Donald Trump won. There are some of you who will believe that there are great things that he is going to do for you, that he is going to do for this country. So let's open our phone lines for Kevin Baker, novelist, essayist, the author most recently of America, the Ingenious, How a Nation of Dreamers, Immigrants, and Tinkerers Changed the World. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. We'll also talk about other times in history. Even in the Great Depression, Kevin writes, we didn't succumb to the ideologies of fascism and communism when the system seemed broken in the past, when the elites and major parties seemed irretrievably corrupt and deaf to their appeals. The response was to build true democratic movements from the ground up and to push them on to victory, even if that took decades. So why now? We'll add that to the mix. We'll be with your phone calls momentarily. First, let's listen to a montage. We began by talking about the city on a hill. Our guest reminds us in his piece in the New York Times that perhaps many of you saw over the course of the weekend that America has been written about. It has been criticized. It has been described perhaps more than any other country. More people have written about the expectations for America and the beauty of what is America. And it has been described by Republican and Democratic presidents in this way. We'll hear a bit of this and then hear some of your phone calls.
We must always consider, he said, that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us.
The past few days, when I've been at that window upstairs, I've thought a bit of the shining city upon a hill. The phrase comes from John Winthrop, who wrote it to describe the America he imagined. What he imagined was important because he was an early pilgrim, an early freedom man.
Right in these waters, where the American experiment began, as the earliest settlers arrived on the shores of Boston and Salem and Plymouth, they dreamed of building a city on a hill. And the world watched, waiting to see if this improbable idea called America would succeed.
Mr. Trump is directing our anger for less than noble purposes. His domestic policies would lead to recession. His foreign policies would make America and the world less safe. He has neither the temperament nor the judgment to be president, and his personal qualities would mean that America would cease to be a shining city on a hill.
The America we lost when Trump won is what we're talking about. The view of Kevin Baker, a novelist and essayist, author of America, the Ingenious. His piece appeared in the Sunday New York Times. And we go to some phone calls now. Let's start with Aaron in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Aaron.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I did not vote for the Donald. I voted for someone who wrote 100 presidential proposals, so I knew what he was going to do. But I'm taking a wait-and-see attitude with Donald because he's already done some good things. I don't agree with everything, like his daycare initiative is a good one to help families. I think he really does care about people. But the thing that he's doing that's very, very important, that he's doing something that I don't know who would do and when, is he's draining the swamp. And that's opened up by the whole Pizzagate, which is a real thing. There's a huge pedophile.
Oh, come on. It's just ridiculous. Let's go to Keith in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Keith.
Hi. My comment, and I guess I'd like to hear from your guest, is that for the immigrants that come into the U.S., for all of those that cannot come across the border but have to come through, in a sense, the traditional way, years ago they went through Ellis Island.
Right.
How do you differentiate between the two? When people can come across the border freely, but, however, there's a large portion of the population that want to enter the U.S., but they can only do via airports and so forth, and they have to do it the legal way.
Yeah, well, already you're supposed to not come into the U.S. except the legal way, and you're not supposed to be able to just walk across the border, although we have some pretty unguarded borders with Canada as well as with Mexico. But you are going to have people coming in any case. They're going to come by boat. They're going to fly in as tourists and not leave. I definitely think we should enforce the laws. And, in fact, the Obama administration deported a record number of illegal immigrants. But you're not going to deport 11 million people, they estimate, who are undocumented. You're not going to deport them without devoting a huge amount of our resources to that. You're not going to probably stop many of them by putting up this wall. It's a symbol only and a bad one. It will maybe appease Trump's voters, but it's going to look like a terrible thing to the rest of the world.
Let's talk about... I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to switch into this other periods in American history, which you write about in your Sunday piece. You write, throughout our history, we've encountered economic shocks much worse than anything we know today, and with many fewer resources. And yet, even in the Great Depression, we didn't succumb to the ideologies of fascism and communism. What is it that's unusual about now? Why didn't we succumb then?
Well, and this is one of the things I find sadly passive about the whole Trump movement. We didn't succumb then because we had enough belief in our system, in our leaders, in each other, to build a much better America. And we did that. You know, it wasn't easy. It wasn't a straightforward thing. But the demagogues who arose in the 30s, people like Father Coughlin or Huey Long, who was a much smarter and more clever individual than Donald Trump, did not ultimately achieve the sort of power he did. And that was because we were able to, at least to some degree, to see through them. The original populace, these were people, started out a few years after the Civil War. And like many Trump voters today, they felt that both major parties, or at least their establishments, were hopelessly corrupt, that we needed something else. They were suffering much worse than Americans are today. They were part of an agricultural community in the United States, and about half of Americans were farmers at the time, which was just collapsing into peonage and tenant farmery. And these are people who had really nothing, and nothing to fall back on. There was no social welfare state at the time. What did they do? Did they elect some con man? I mean, the idea that a New York real estate developer with six bankruptcies in his past was going to be devoted to their welfare would have made them laugh. What they did instead was they set up a nationwide network of correspondents and of speaking bureaus and got their message out there and started a third party for a while, then got co-opted kind of into the Democratic Party, but still kept pushing for what they wanted and finally achieved most of it, most of agricultural reform in the New Deal in the 1930s. This was a 60 to 70 year process. And the same can be said for one people's liberation movement after another. You look at women. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were dead by the time women finally got the vote. They had been at the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848. Women don't get the vote until 1919. So this was really this long battle that people went through. You know, the African Americans starting the NAACP and then training their own lawyers to battle Jim Crow and finally overturning it with the Supreme Court in 1954 with Brown v. Board, and then going on to going into the streets with this greatest pacifist movement we've ever had with the SCLC and Dr. King. These were things that took years, and they took the involvement of everyone. And they didn't just depend on saying, oh, this guy on the TV says he'll fix everything. And I don't know if that is the outcome of generations of watching TV or the social media we're so obsessed with today or what, but it is way too passive a thing for members of the world's oldest and what was the greatest democracy to have resorted to.
And yet you had the day after the inauguration. I don't think you can underestimate the size of resistance to him. It was millions of people, and it was all over the world. What did that say?
That was great to see, and it did show the world that there was a lot of resistance to this person. And incidentally, as sort of a side note, we really need to fix our anachronistic constitutional system of electing people. I don't think there's another case in recorded human history of one party taking a national election by almost 3 million votes and losing everything. This is, the Electoral College is an antiquated thing, and it really should go, but I know there's not much hope of that soon. But that was a nice thing to see. Now we'll see if people will follow up with the hard work of organizing and organizing on the grassroots level. You know, I think things like the Green Party running another candidate who cannot possibly win are really counterproductive. An alternative to Trump, an alternative to this alt-right movement that he's the convenient leader of, will need to be counteracted by people building something from the grassroots up. That's what it's going to take.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Susan in West Dallas. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hello.
I was thinking about what it must have been like to come across the ocean hundreds of years ago. It couldn't have been a very pleasant journey, and it takes a certain type of person to dare that much. And I think this contributed so much to American character. And if you ask me, you know, there's so much talk these days about grit. If that isn't grit, I don't know what is.
Yes.
I think by denying these people, it's going to really detract from our American character.
Yeah. I think you're very right. And like Kathleen, I have some relatives from Ireland who came over. And you can imagine that. I mean, going through the Irish famine, this horrendous event where something like 1 million people out of 8 million on the island died, and making it to what were called coffin ships because they were so badly provisioned that many more people died on the way over, and getting off the boat and coming here and making a life for yourselves, that's pretty amazing. The even worse journey of the Middle Passage, of African slaves being, you know, carted over here and by people who tried to strip them of everything, their culture, a language, and them still persevering and still making it to full citizenry. These are incredible, epic journeys for peoples and a lot of different peoples. And we need to honor that. We need to see that there are people who are still undergoing it. Sure, check people's backgrounds, make sure nobody's coming in who's a terrorist as much as you can. But the idea that immigrants are to blame for some terrible thing going on in this country, that's just balderdash, and we're going to miss out on a lot by giving into that feeling.
Thank you, Susan, very much for your call. And then this all gets enormously complicated pretty darn fast, doesn't it? You think of the huge number of Syrian refugees who evidently are not going to be allowed in here at all for a while. And all of these people who have been facing humanitarian disasters. We've gotten to know some Syrian refugees who are just the most delightful people I know. I just trust them with my life, for heaven's sake, who are living here now. And you've got this war that's creating a situation. So you've got a war, you've got to figure out an end to the war, and you have to figure out some humane way to treat all of the people who've had their houses bombed and lost family members.
Yeah, very much so. And it is a very difficult thing. And I know Europe is struggling with a lot of it now, with some people as to, you know, who are you going to be, a European or not? But that's more of a problem there, I think, because the idea of who's a Frenchman or who's a German is something that is much more specific. We have, again, this idea of who is an American, an idea that's constantly changing and constantly being fought over and constantly evolving. I'm sure almost everyone we took from Syria would turn out to be a terrific addition to our country. Yes, of course, we should be vigilant, but we can't throw out the rest of the world with the bad people.
Mm-hmm. So what do you, another thing that we haven't heard details on, but Donald Trump has promised that he's going to bring jobs back. Mm-hmm. He's told American corporations you're going to have to pay big fees if you move overseas. Your stuff is going to be taxed at a higher level. People are concerned about globalization, and rightfully so. Jobs are gone. Manufacturing jobs are gone. He's also talked about $1 trillion in infrastructure programs in this country. Will those be actions that might make you change your mind about him?
I doubt very much that they would make me change my mind about him, and I doubt very much if they will be done in a useful, uncorrupted way. But I do think one of the things that the Clintonist wing of the Democrats really suffered from, and in this I include President Obama as well, classy and act as he was in the White House, a failure to acknowledge that what's been going on leaves a lot of people behind. You know, at times Clintonism reminds me of that some ad for some internet security company, which makes fun of its rivals by having them say, "Oh, we don't do anything about the problem. We just monitor it." You know, and they have like a bank robbery going on, and the bank guard, people are saying, "Do something." He says, "Oh, I don't solve the bank robbery. I just tell you when it's happening. This is a bank robbery." And that was, to a certain degree, Clintonism. I felt there was a lot of astute analysis of how the world was changing economically between globalization and automation, and those were not easy problems to deal with. But their solutions to simply say, it often seemed to be simply, well, everybody should go to college and get a couple more degrees and become a white-collar worker.
Yes.
That wasn't going to happen in a country which has a 30%, I believe, college graduation rate. There had to be something else done to deal with this changing work environment, and there still does. And it's going to be a complicated set of things. And I think a big failure of the Obama administration was not putting together a huge infrastructure program right away and insisting on that. Some things were done that were good, but I think there needed to be much more of that right out of the box. And also keeping people in their homes.
Yes.
That needed to be dealt with. There's something like 9 million families who are underwater. This should have been something that the Democrats should have looked into immediately.
Well, and you know, at their great loss, because look what's happened to the Democratic Party. So my question to you is, you know, the state houses, the Republican control is absolute and is complete in Washington and in many state houses. So how are they to make things different? Or is it just not in the purview of the Democratic Party to do that, or the Republican Party, for that matter?
It's a huge problem for the Democrats in particular. They've really just are kind of disappearing in certain parts of the country, and they need to have an answer to modernity, to what's going on now. You know, a lot of the Trump supporters, they seem to demand that it be 1956 again, which is to say a social welfare state that serves basically white people. And that's not ever coming back.
But at the same time, we do have to deal with the problems that working people have in this country and deal with them seriously. And until Democrats do that, I don't know if they'll make any progress. I think the only thing Democrats can really do is sort of start off at the local and state level. And in those states they do control, build a better way of doing things, show a better way of doing things. I hope they're going to be doing that in places like California, which is the world's sixth largest economy, and the Northeast. We can build regional systems. There are ways of doing that, and we have to show that it can be done. And that's going to be a lot of hard work that's going to take a long time.
We're welcoming phone calls. Our guest is the author of a piece that was in the New York Times on Sunday, The America We Lost When Trump Won. Kevin Baker, a novelist and essayist, author of America the Ingenious, is our guest. Do you agree with his headline here that we lost when Trump won? For those of you who voted for Donald Trump, obviously you think that he's going to do good things for this country. Can we outline what those are? If you think that America lost, how so? Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. And joining us this hour to talk about the election of Donald Trump is, as we said, the author of America the Ingenious, Kevin Baker. He had a piece in Sunday's New York Times, which we have posted on our Facebook page if you'd like to read it, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Paul in Plainfield, hi.
Hi. I have two things. First, when you talk about the presidential election, I think we had Dumb and Dumberer as running for office. I didn't like either party. But my question is this: what's the difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien? I see a lot of people mixing those up because I think it's a slap in the face to some people. And I know two Muslims and a Canadian who went through all the paperwork, got their green cards, and are wonderful contributors to our society. Those are immigrants. The people who come across illegally are here illegally. If we're a nation of laws, we need to follow the laws.
I am all for following the law, and I think people should come here legally. But I'm just not going to scapegoat those people who didn't as some kind of menace to us all when the vast majority of them are people who desperately want to make their lives better and the lives of their families better, and who are in many, many cases doing jobs that Americans won't do. And I'm not going to go out and castigate these people as some big threat to the Republic, because I don't think they are.
And I'm wondering what happens to businesses when those people are deported, if indeed they are. Who will fill those jobs, Kevin?
I'm not sure. I remember a couple of years ago there was a thing. Didn't Alabama issue some blanket thing to kick everyone out?
Yeah, I remember that.
And then there was a whole thing where they had to, bring them back in. The whole immigration system could use a good look at. You know, currently you can sort of buy green cards for $500,000 by becoming an investor. So it's set up perfectly well for very wealthy people who are often oligarchs in other countries and want a bolt hole here in the United States. So that's the sort of thing that goes on. I have much less trouble with somebody who's an honest Mexican immigrant, illegal immigrant, but coming in here and trying to get a decent job for his family. And if you really want to just cut down on illegal immigration, what you should really be doing is hammering a lot of the companies, the big companies, who hire undocumented workers. And that somehow never seems to manifest itself as even a real proposal from the Republicans. So I'm skeptical about how much honesty there is on this issue.
John in Janesville, hi.
How are you doing?
All right, John, how are you?
Hello. Not too bad. I was wondering, he was supposed to get rid of all of his companies, all of his holdings and stuff in all the companies, according to the Constitution. Yeah. And he was supposed to turn in his tax records, which he never did. I don't think he should be able to sign any paper saying anything until he does what he's supposed to have done.
Oh, I certainly agree, although that the tax records part is not mandated in the Constitution or under the law. But, yes, he has a huge conflict of interest in a lot of things. His son has said that their company a few years ago, he's saying their company is making an enormous amount of money from Russia, a connection that's nefarious, to say the least. So, yeah, this is a guy with a ton of conflicts of interest. And for all that he talks about wanting to put average Americans back to work, he's filled the cabinet with members of the Goldman Sachs firm. So you really have to wonder about who all this, these great future things he's planning to do will be, and on whose behalf will they be done. There might be some that trickles down, but there's going to be a lot that goes to the same people filling up the swamp, as he called it, in Washington. This is not I don't see a lot of lobbyists packing up and leaving and saying their day is done. This is going to be a great big barbecue for them.
Kevin, what's the latest? I haven't read very much. It's just a daily onslaught of all kinds of news. But Do you know what's been happening with the FBI investigation, with the Senate Intelligence Committee? I guess the House is taking up an investigation of potential Russian ties to the Trump Organization.
Yeah, as I understand it, the people in the House are trying to get that going, and the FBI has admitted that it's carrying on an ongoing investigation. I would not expect to see very much in terms of a result from any of them, or even a report in the end. I don't think the Republicans who control both houses will let anything come out, and I don't think the FBI, which seems to have turned into an adjunct of the Republican Party, I don't think they're going to find that there was any wrongdoing. So this is part of the cost of losing the election. I'm all for Democrats continuing to try to look into all this more. It's certainly worthwhile.
Thanks, John. Dean in Beaver Dam. Hi.
Hi, I tuned in late, so I hope I'm not being redundant. I'd like Mr. Baker's response to a couple of thoughts that I've had. We know what's going to happen if we wall ourselves off and continue this American First idea and set up tariffs. We can go back into history and see how it damaged the United States. We can predict very easily what's going to happen if we get rid of all illegal immigrants. And finally, the right wing will realize that when they're paying $6 for a head of lettuce or $10 a pound for a chicken. We can look at history. And to me, part of the blame here sits squarely with the media. They could have done, every time Trump came out with one of these ridiculous proposals, said, well, let's look at that historically and factually.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of criticism of the media throughout the campaign. I think to a certain degree the media felt it was giving him enough rope to hang himself, that they were exposing just what a person he was by showing those speeches. And with the America I used to know, that would have been the case. There was some pretty good analysis of what his proposals meant in things like the New York Times. I think one problem with the media, too, now, is that a lot of it is dying. The more serious news is always newspaper news. That television took a lot of its cues from that. And papers all over the country now are just short of funds. They can't send out investigative teams, and they're really going down in one city after another, and it's being replaced by this sort of new media, which includes a lot of fake news sites.
It is something. I don't know how we address this. And our second hour looks at the conservative viewpoint on this. But it is true that when you look at cable news particularly, how often do you have any kind of historical reference so that we learn something? And there's so much to be learned about from what's happened before us, and yet there is almost none of that.
Yes, yeah. You occasionally get some on MSNBC, but not a whole lot that goes back to the 19th century. You know, there's nobody. It was interesting that Trump
about 5 minutes ago, decided that he was the reincarnation of Andy Jackson.
Exactly. I was just going to bring him up. I know.
That would have been interesting to go into a little talk about, you know, probably the last time a movement that was seen as this radical took power. Excuse me. But there's not a lot of we're not a backwards looking people, which is often very good. You know, you don't want to be still talking about the Battle of the Boyne or the, you know, the Field of Crows, but as other people's are. But at the same time, you need to learn something from history, and I fear we're too detached from our history now.
Yeah, I read, I think, in the Post yesterday that he went through the White House portraits in the basement or wherever they're stored, and he selected Andrew Jackson to put in the Oval Office.
Yes, something that would probably appall Andy Jackson, who was, for all the bad he did toward the Cherokees and other Native American peoples, was an extraordinary individual who was a war hero and basically conquered a huge section of the country. He has a few bona fides that Mr. Trump does not, but we'll see how much he lives up to Old Hickory.
Dean, thanks for the call. Jim in Oconomowoc, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having an interesting guest. I agree with his overall thesis and articulation of it. Very interesting, and his piece is in my stack of things to read. I read a piece by Robert Kaplan about Manifest Destiny a couple weeks before that, and in his piece also, he glosses over in a late paragraph, you know, the genocide and slavery issue, and I think those should be front and center. And, I think, you know, because of the it's kind of like the original sin of the United States, and it's great to love your country, but you need to know the country you love. And
absolutely,
you know, it's like the stolen land and genocide, and it's the free labor of stolen peoples. And yeah. You know, people need to know about that and think about that before, you know, a lot of this other stuff. And there's a couple of books that I might recommend. One is The Indigenous History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And the other one is, she was at UCLA, and another one is by a Harvard historian named Bernard Balin, and it's The Barbarous Years, The Peopling of British North America. He's won like 3 Pulitzer Prizes, and it's a hard book to read, but it's pretty tough. So,
I would totally agree, and I'd also add to that list Craig Stephen Wilder's Ebony and Ivy, about how much these high Ivy League schools and others have benefited from slavery, and also Steve Inskeep's wonderful Jacksonland, about just what was perpetrated upon the Indians of the Southeast United States. And I think all that is true, and I think we should always keep that before us, where we didn't live up to our ideals, and in fact where we did downright awful things. But at the same time, I think we have dealt with this as almost no other nation has. I mean, it would have been absolutely impossible to imagine a European nation electing, however socially democratic and liberal they are, electing someone like Barack Obama president. These are states that dealt a lot in the slave trade too, but have not really dealt with having an African-American population. And I think that has been the great thing about America, is we've taken on these problems and this past, and at least tried to improve upon it. And that includes a lot of these peoples themselves demanding their rights. I think that's been also part of that legacy. So, you know, it's always a mixed legacy for any big power. But I think here, the stones which the builder has rejected have become the cornerstones to an amazing degree, and that's to our credit. So we shouldn't overlook that part of our past as well. The
Kevin,
question is, what are we going to do now?
If you were, maybe this will be an indication of how worried you are, and I'm not sure how worried you are about our future. We have about a minute left to let you know. If you were being born today, do you think it might be better to be born in Belgium, Ecuador, or Thailand?
I have no idea, and I still have some hope for us. But I think we have to face this very directly. What a sort of desecration of our democracy this was, and face what a wrong turn it was before anything is going to improve. But yeah, I would still bet on America.
Thank you, Kevin, very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Baker, he's a novelist and essayist, author of America the Ingenious. There is a piece in Sunday's review in the New York Times, that section by Kevin, that is titled The America We Lost When Trump Won. And it is on our Facebook page if you'd like to go there. If you couldn't get on the air, we had a lot of phone calls, so just go to our Facebook page and leave your messages there, and we will read them. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Coming up, our number two of our show will be looking at these young Republicans who are participating in very rigorous book clubs, studying and discussing intellectual traditions of conservatism. It's an interesting movement that has grown up, so we will talk about that and welcome your phone calls. Thanks very much for listening and participating in hour number one.